It's 7:08 and you're listening to Upfront. I'm Janine Etter in for Salima Morani. 45 years after the landmark U.S. Supreme Court case Roe v. Wade, the Trump administration has issued a domestic gag rule which would impose curbs on abortion rights. Roe v. Wade passed on January 22, 1973. The U.S. Supreme Court, in a 7-2 decision, affirmed the legality of a woman's right to have an abortion under the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. The court held that a woman's right to have an abortion fell within the right to privacy protected by the 14th Amendment. This decision gave a woman the right to an abortion during the entirety of her pregnancy. It defined different levels of state interest for regulating abortion in the second and third trimesters. Trump, who in 1999 claimed to be pro-choice, has since changed his tune to pro-life, many say to appease his Christian evangelical conservative base. Joining us to discuss the policy and how this will impact a woman's right to privacy is obstetrician-gynecologist Dr. Peggy Yee, practicing at MedStar Washington Hospital Center in Washington, D.C. Dr. Peggy Yee, thank you for speaking with me today.
Thank you, Janine, for having me. I'm really excited to talk about this topic that's so important for women's health.
So tell me about it. Talk about the abortion gag rule and how restrictive is it?
Certainly. So the rule applies to Title X programs. And Title X is the nation's program for affordable birth control and reproductive health care. It's been in place since the 1970s. And this program is basically there to help ensure that every person, regardless of where they live, how much money they make, their background, whether or not they have health insurance, actually has access to basic preventive reproductive health care. So this includes birth control, cancer screening, sexually transmitted infection testing and treatment, as well as well woman exams. And the problem with this rule is that it forbids people who, providers at Title X clinics, from being able to make referrals for abortions for patients who are considering that as an option.
So talk about what's termed as the Mexico City policy in relation to the gag rule.
So the Mexico City policy is a little bit different. This is what they term an international gag rule. And basically for international companies or aid organizations that provide international aid, they also cannot make any referrals or even discuss abortion as part of the requirement for receiving federal funding. So it is a little bit different from what is in play here for Title X. The Mexico City rule is the international gag rule, affects reproductive aid organizations in that they cannot speak or provide referrals for abortion services to receive any federal aid funding. But this is a domestic policy for only Title X providers. And this policy really interferes with our, as a physician, our ability to really fully counsel a patient, because for women who are considering abortion as an option, this new proposed policy will not allow sites who have Title X funding to be able to fully discuss abortion or particularly make any referrals to abortion providers.
So paint a picture for me. You are practicing at MedStar Washington Hospital Center?
Yes, that is where I practice.
So a woman comes to you and she finds out she's pregnant. What can you tell her about her options under this new rule?
So under this new rule, if a patient has not explicitly decided and has explicitly asked for information about abortion, you actually can't necessarily fully counsel her. So if she's just considering it as an option, I actually would have to give her referrals that include places that provide abortions as well as places that actually don't provide abortions. So, for example, let's just take it to another context. If I had a patient who was diagnosed with, like, let's say cancer, and she needed a referral for somebody who treats cancer, I have to provide her a list of people who both treat cancer as well as people who actually don't treat cancer. And you don't necessarily, we're not necessarily able to differentiate between those who do provide the treatment and those who don't. And so it's really confusing for patients, and it actually delays their ability to get timely care.
So you're saying that if she already knew that she was going to have an abortion, then you could refer her, but if she did not, you could not suggest abortion?
Yes, that is the case.
Okay. So how will this impact the health and the lives of women?
So first, patients really depend on their medical providers to be able to get accurate information. And to have outside, you know, politicians tell me that I can't tell a patient what she wants to hear or know and about if she doesn't have all of her options in front of her, that really impacts the physician-patient relationship. It erodes the trust the patient has in me, and it's really against all of our moral and ethical obligations to provide care for a patient. Secondly, we also know that the earlier a patient gets timely access to abortion, the safer. The vast majority of abortions are performed in their first trimester, and they are incredibly safe. In fact, a recent study published by the National Academy of Medicine confirmed the safety of abortion and confirmed that it was very safe, especially in the first trimester when the majority of patients receive their abortions. So if there's any delay in a person who's decided on abortion or is considering an abortion, if there's any delay in her getting care, it can actually increase the risks to her.
Well, what are your thoughts about the restrictive abortion bills being put forward by the right, such as the heartbeat bill that's now law, that recently passed in Iowa that takes effect July 1st, and this is banning abortions after 6 weeks once a heartbeat is detected?
Yes, it's incredibly difficult. These recent bills in Iowa, Mississippi, and Louisiana are a part of a very large movement to eliminate access to abortion on the state level. You know, abortion is actually really common. About 1 in 4 women will have an abortion by the time that she is 45 years of age. And actually, the vast majority of Americans do support legal access to abortion care. About 7 in 10 Americans support the ability for patients to get an abortion if they want. So these bills are really out of touch with American values.
Well, they seem to be touting evangelical and biblical values. That seems to be the reasoning behind the restrictive abortion bills. Even Republican governor of Iowa, Kim Reynolds, stated that when she was signing the bill, that her faith leads her to protect life. What does this mean in terms of the separation of church and state, would you say?
You know, some of these finer points may be best left to the lawyers, but there is also a constitutional right for women to access abortion if they so choose. That has been in place since Roe versus Wade was passed in the 1970s. And although she may feel like she is in step with her own values, you know, again, the data says that actually most Americans do support the access, legal provision of abortion in the United States.
And can you talk about what's termed back alley abortions and what this new gag rule might mean in terms of women's health, if back alley abortions were to return?
Yes. So back alley abortions, so thankfully, is out of the general discourse these days ever since abortion was legalized in the United States. What back alley abortions used to refer to were abortions provided by unlicensed practitioners. These generally were abortions that were unsafe and clandestine. They were often done with equipment that was not sterile. And as a result, patients who had a quote-unquote back alley abortion were at much higher risk of having an infection, experiencing severe hemorrhage. Back before abortion was legalized in the United States, many hospitals were filled with patients who had what we used to call a septic abortion. So an attempted abortion that resulted in an infection, incomplete removal of the pregnancy, and required patients to be admitted for IV intravenous antibiotics and much heightened hospital care. The concern with restricting abortion is that without legal access to abortion, without timely access to abortions, patients may attempt to resort to these other methods, whether it's self-induced abortion with attempting to get medications over the border internationally, or with other methods to attempt to self-induce an abortion, or potentially going to an unlicensed practitioner, somebody who is not regulated, to try and procure an abortion that is unsafe. Internationally, unsafe abortion is one of the leading causes of maternal mortality. And luckily here in the United States, since legalization, the morbidity, meaning the complications and the threat to women's health, is much less because of legalized abortion.
And is it your view that based on the gag rule and anti-abortion legislation, that there's a danger of back alley and self-induced abortions, health risks?
Yes. I certainly think that abortion restrictions will affect women who are trying to safely obtain access to legal reproductive health care. Women who are very motivated to end their pregnancies will attempt to do so in potentially ways that are unsafe. And there are reports, particularly in areas that are near the Mexican border, of patients increasing experiences with attempting to self-induce abortions. Now, as far as the Title 10 gag rule, that may be a little bit more difficult to parse out, but we do know that if women don't get a timely referral to abortion, that it can delay their access, it can delay their ability to obtain that abortion, and it can increase the risks as they get further along in the pregnancy.
Under Title 10, what specific clinics are affected?
So Title 10 covers a lot of clinics that serve people of low income, and particularly people of color. So this includes federally qualified health centers, as well as Planned Parenthood. This program serves about 4 million people a year, and Planned Parenthood by itself accounts for about 41% of Title 10 patients.
So this gag rule will disproportionately affect Black and brown women and poor women.
Yes, that is correct.
Can you paint a picture again of how specifically this will affect communities of color and poor communities?
So Title 10 is there to for people who are low income and people of color. And we do know that people of color are disproportionately affected by many adverse health outcomes. Oftentimes they have difficulty accessing basic preventive health care. And so to have a rule that impacts a provider at a Title 10 clinic's ability to provide routine medical care and be able to give their patients, who are disproportionately of low income and disproportionately of color, give them accurate medical advice and accurate, timely referrals can really impact their health. So, for example, a patient who comes in and is just diagnosed with an unexpected pregnancy when she is, you know, coming in to start birth control, for example. If she is unsure about what she wants to do with that pregnancy, which she probably is, given that, you know, this is an unexpected pregnancy, she's just coming in for birth control, and she takes that pregnancy test, and she finds that it's unexpectedly positive. You know, with this rule, her provider at this Title 10 clinic actually can only talk about potentially continuing the pregnancy. They can't discuss abortion. They can't give her a referral for a provider who happens to do abortions if she's not certain about what she wants to do yet. We also know that people who are of low income have difficulty being able to get, for example, an abortion that they want, if that's what she's decided. It's not, an abortion is not routinely covered under health insurances, and so this is a cost that she will have to pay, and she'll have to get money together to be able to procure that abortion. When a patient has low income, every dollar matters, and so sometimes it's very difficult for her to scrape together the money, and it can delay her care.
Well, this is a little controversial, because the history of Planned Parenthood essentially being founded by Margaret Sanger, a part of the now discredited eugenics movement, which was a science of improving a human population by controlled breeding to increase the occurrence of desirable characteristics. Mm-hmm. What is your take on that controversial founder, Margaret Sanger, and how does it apply to specifically communities of color that Planned Parenthood serves?
What I will say about that, and I am not a representative of Planned Parenthood, but I think that the founder, Margaret Sanger, is, you know, I would say that the organization now is probably quite different from what it was when it was founded, just like medical care in general. And reproductive health care isn't without its significant controversies, particularly with regards to people of color. You know, besides the eugenics movement, forced sterilization in the past, and many other things, I think that the best way to focus it on now, to focus now, is, you know, what is Planned Parenthood and other Title X carriers, what are they doing now for people of color? Are they serving their patients' needs now in the modern day, or are they still beholden to this legacy that they, you know, potentially used to have? I would say that right now, the modern Planned Parenthood is a clinic that really works on serving their communities, whether that is patients of color, or just any other low-income patient. They really are progressive in ensuring that they have the most up-to-date reproductive health care and that they are serving patients regardless of their ability to pay. And, you know, I have in the past worked at a Planned Parenthood, and I've been very impressed with how quickly they've updated their medical protocols, update their medical treatments. And, you know, I would say that, you know, I think that they are really working to serve their communities and not necessarily be based on, you know, their founding 100 years ago. Like I said, many things have changed. If we were practicing medicine and taking care of patients the way that we were 100 years ago, gosh, probably half of us wouldn't still be alive.
Well, I also would like to say that from my research, she was not part of the eugenics movement that was based on race, that she denounced the racist wing, if you will, of the eugenics movement. Meanwhile, in other parts of the world, Northern Ireland has voted yes to end the country's ban on abortion after a historic referendum. Do you think that what's happening in Northern Ireland will have an impact on abortion, on the abortion debate here in the States?
You know, Ireland is a very interesting case because a lot of their movement towards legalizing abortion was based on the tragedy of having a woman have to die because she couldn't get a timely abortion because of their restrictive laws. And I certainly hope that the United States never goes to that point where a woman has to die before we can change our laws.
Nathan Larson, he's an open pedophile who's running for Congress in Charlottesville, Virginia, and he has urged Congress to repeal the Violence Against Women Act and is quoted as saying that we need to switch to a system that classifies women as property, initially of their fathers and later of their husbands. Now, as shocking as that may sound, he's part of a group of people who feel the same way, shockingly. How hard is this fight going to be to maintain constitutional reproductive rights for women?
Oh, you know, what an interesting time that we live in where we have to openly entertain and actively discredit a pedophile.
Right.
It's just unbelievable. You know, I really have to have my faith in the fact that right now, at least, people are still see the value of reproductive health, see the value of maintaining healthy women and healthy families, despite what some of these more openly emboldened men often say. You know, again, most Americans support access to legal abortion. And it's because of this history that we've had with people who've had, women in the past who've had all these complications, similar to what they experienced in Ireland. And, you know, it is a fight. It's been a fight. And we'll continue to fight for what's needed for women's health, no matter how hard it is.
Well, on the other side, like the March for Life, which touts itself as being the largest pro-life event in the world, recently took place in San Francisco in January and does every year as a counter-protest to Roe v. Wade, which passed in January of 1973. They call legalized abortion a human rights violation. What's your response to that?
I go back to my patients and I respond, you know, to the woman who's sitting in front of me. I want to do what she needs from me as a provider and as a physician. So whether that counseling is for an abortion, that's legal, I will provide that for her. If she decides that it's best for her family to continue the pregnancy and she's in a stable position to raise another child, to raise a family, then that's what matters to me. My care is rooted in women's health, in caring and making sure that a woman and her family are healthy. And that is what's important to me. So whether that's providing, you know, her annual exams, her sexually transmitted infection screening, cancer screening, or the abortion, it's all part of preventive health care. And I think what's really important is that we support the women and the families that exist.
So in some type of alternate universe, pro-life groups got their way and abortions were banned. What would that look like overall for women's health? How would that impact?
Oh, that would be really bad for women's health. Turning back the clock is hopefully not going to be an option for us. We've seen it happen before. In the 1970s, abortion was not legal in the United States. It was legal initially in several states, California and New York, and we don't have to look back far. 1970s is about 40 years ago. We saw, again, women die from their septic abortions. We saw women come in with infections. We've seen women bleed to death in hotel rooms where they attempted to self-induce abortions. So I don't think that we necessarily have to go to great lengths to paint a picture. Certainly many of us who were born after the 70s don't remember this, but those who were around then do. And oftentimes you'll find that they are very, very emphatic in their support for women's reproductive health care, including access to abortion.
And is there anything else you'd like to add?
This gag rule for the Title X clinics is just really so onerous. It prevents women and their physicians from establishing a trusted relationship. It impacts my ability to give patients the information that they want and need. Major medical associations join me in opposing this rule: the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the American College of Physicians, and many other academic medical societies oppose this political intrusion in our exam rooms.
And what is it that people can do if they want to support those organizations or get involved in this fight for abortion rights?
Yes. So everything's about social media these days. You know, your listeners who want to are motivated to fight against abortion restrictions and fight against this gag rule should be active on social media. There are lots and lots of rallies that are going around. There are rallies to support Planned Parenthood. There are rallies for other reproductive health care organizations. They should be out there and open. And certainly they should call the representatives to tell them that they do not want this rule implemented. And when this rule is finally published and open for public comment, they should look out and try to send in public comments against it as well.
Okay, Dr. Peggy Yee, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Janine.
That was Dr. Peggy Yee, practicing obstetrician gynecologist at MedStar Washington Hospital Center in Washington, D.C., speaking about the impact of the new domestic abortion gag rule.